Hi, this is Debbie, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help you with everything from selecting the perfect window treatment to...
I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. And I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
Yeah, we can also send you samples, fast and free.
Wow, I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, no pressure, no hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Oh, okay, whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over.
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and get up to 40% off with minimum purchase. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Say yes to Pure Leaf tea and free gas for a year only at True North convenience stores. When it comes to quality, say yes to the delicious taste of real brewed Pure Leaf tea. True North stores are stocked with your favorite flavors like unsweetened, extra sweet, and raspberry. For a limited time, enter for a chance to win free gas for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or download the mobile app from the Apple or Google Play stores. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Some people follow the rules, I break them. I'm Soraya, and on Rule Breakers, we talk to the rebels who do things their way. Listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Oh, I love Chuck.
Yeah, it's hysterical. Hard to play there, you know, that thin air.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We are delighted to welcome in the head coach of the Chicago Bulls, doing a remarkable job. Billy Donovan joins us on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, Aturo.com. Good morning, Coach. How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you doing?
Doing well.
I got to tell you, we are really having fun watching your team. And the way that you play, the way that, I heard Malone saying after the game, I heard him say it before the game, that you guys are maybe the best running team in the NBA, and that is a real compliment for a guy that plays out west and tries to run people off the court sometimes when he can with that thin air.
Well, Mike and I go back a long way. We actually grew up in the same neighborhood, knew his father really well, and we've had a very, very close relationship and, you know, appreciate the kind words. But, you know, I think one of the things that we said, you know, to start the season was we had to play that way. And we talked about it, you know, in the training camp media day. I think I made the comment, if we don't run, we're done, you know. And I think the guys deserve a lot of credit. You know, we totally changed stylistically the way we were kind of playing in the past because I think our personnel changed. So guys did a great job coming back in shape. I thought the 3 weeks leading up to the start of training camp, you know, everybody came in. We really started to try to play that way when these guys played a lot of pickup ball. We played with a 14-second shot clock for most of the preseason. I think that kind of set a foundation for us. And then, you know, we've been able to stay consistent with it. And the guys have really done a good job of trying to night in and night out play to that identity.
You know, Billy, I think that it's obvious to see the evidence of your coaching on the way your team has played, whether it's the last 10 games or really since the Zach LaVine trade. But I think it's there. And we have kidded about, well, you know what, even despite your record, you could be a candidate for the coach of the year. And I know you're not going to acknowledge that, and I know that you're not going to be in on that conversation. But I do wonder, if you take a step back, how would you describe, you changed the style, you changed the approach, you changed the pace. So how would you describe the overall impact that you've had as a coach on this team compared to previous seasons in Chicago?
Yeah, man, I think every season is always a little bit different, you know, and There's certainly, since I've been here, you know, a lot of change, quite honestly. And I know the Lonzo Ball injury, you know, in my second year, you know, that kind of altered things. And I know that we kind of played for a period of time, you know, without a point guard. I thought Io came in as a rookie when we lost Caruso and we lost Lonzo and really did a remarkable job. But, you know, I look at the way the teams have changed and the way we flowed. And, you know, I think when you come in at this level, you know, whatever, you're certainly going to have philosophical beliefs in terms of the way the game's played. But you are, in a lot of ways, I think, responsible to try to play in a way that really magnifies, puts guys in position to do what they do well. I love DeMar DeRozan. You know, he was one of the best closers that I've ever had a chance to coach. You know, I think Zach LaVine has been one of the most gifted scorers I've ever had a chance to coach. Vooch is a very, very smart player. And, you know, I think earlier on, you know, we tried to play to those guys' strengths in a lot of ways. And then with some of our point guard situation being in flux, you know, I didn't think that the best thing for our team was to kind of play that way. So, you know, Zach's always been a great transition player. He's always been up there as one of the league leaders scoring in transition. He's tremendous in that area. And I give the guys a lot of credit because when you start this journey going into the season, it starts well before training camp. You know, you go out, you meet with players, guys get together, and you start to talk about the season, the identity, and how we need to play. And I give the guys a lot of credit. They were all bought in and believed that this is what we had to do to be successful and how we needed to play. So I think from that standpoint, I always say at this level, there's voluntary cooperation. Everybody's got to work together. And this has been a great group to work with. I enjoyed working with all the groups here in Chicago. All the guys I've had a chance to work with have been great guys. And I feel like I've really, really tried to do the best job that they can to play in a way that we needed to play.
I don't want to just sit here and keep complimenting you, but I think one of the most remarkable aspects about watching this season has been sort of with three players in particular that are playing so differently now than they did earlier in the year. And you know, obviously Kobe has emerged. He's playing now like he's an all-star player. I don't know if there's another level for him, and there could be, but he's playing like he belongs in an all-star game. Josh Giddey is playing a complete and all-around game as well as anybody, and I'm not sure we were seeing that before. And then Matas is another example of a guy who you didn't give a ton of minutes to, who you kind of made earn his minutes. He wasn't involved late in games, and you've created this confidence in all three of those players that has changed the way that they're playing the game. And I think it's by holding them accountable and by, you know, kind of especially maybe with Giddey and Matas, and then helping helping Kobe become the player he is. I feel there's a confidence to this group that was not there earlier in the year.
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit is that's accurate. You know, one of the things that, you know, when I first came here and Larry Marketing was here and Wendell Carter was here and Kobe was here, you know, I think when those guys are high draft picks, there's this perception or feeling that these guys are going to be the future. And what ends up happening is these guys get put into leadership roles and responsibilities that they are not equipped or capable of handling at their age. And, you know, I had this conversation with Kobe in the summer, and he, every year I've been with him, I feel like every year has taken a step. And it's really a great credit to him that whatever is thrown at him, he always looks at internally of how he can be better. He's never been an excuse maker or point fingers or cast blame. And his role has changed quite a bit for us. But I had this conversation with Kobe. I had it with Io, and I had it with Patrick Williams, just because these guys were going into their fourth, fifth, sixth years as NBA players. And I said, there comes a point in time in all your guys' career you know, as starters, that the leadership responsibility falls on your shoulders. And you guys are in a position right now that you have enough experience. What you're going to be judged and evaluated on is how well can you lead. It's not only about your own individual performance, but it's how well can you lead through your experiences. And I think you probably last year started to see Kobe's voice emerge. You started to see Io's voice emerge. And I think even Patrick Williams, you know, tried to do that. All three of them have been great team guys. All three of those guys really, really want to win. And I think that they've got a really good understanding that it takes everybody. And it takes chemistry. And it takes cohesiveness. And it takes everybody being on the same page. And not only has Kobe played at an incredible level, a lot of people don't get a chance to see and hear what goes on inside the locker room, huddles, and practice. He has been a phenomenal leader. And I think one of the most powerful things that ends up happening, you know, during the course of the season is belief. I thought DeMar last year, quite honestly, when we had a lot of injuries and we lost players like Zach and Patrick for the rest of the season, DeMar was a guy that gave the group great belief that we could win. And I think Kobe's done the same thing. I think some of these players learn things from different players, but those guys have done a remarkable job leading. You know, as it relates to Modest, I think one of the things that has happened for him, when you've got a player, and he's really talented, and I think everybody can see the talent level, but sometimes he doesn't, early on, didn't understand how hard he needed to compete and play on a nightly basis. And he just, a lot of times, was able to ramp up his talent, and that was good enough as a younger player. Well, the talent level's evened out right now. And the biggest thing I've told him is the three things he needs to be accountable to, you know, every day is toughness, intensity, and his energy. If he does that, his talent, you know, will come out. If he doesn't play like that, you start to see a lack of strength, a lack of experience, you know, and a lack of sometimes understanding of who he's guarding, personnel, and those kind of things. So he's done a good job of, when you do hold him accountable, when you do get on him, he doesn't pout. He takes it. He tries to get better from it. And as a young player, I give Miles a lot of credit. I've been around a lot of young players. When there's any level of criticism or there's any level of, you know, taking a guy out of the game, there can be pouting. There can be not understanding. Modest uses mistakes and adversity as a way to try to get better. And this was one of the things I had talked about earlier in the year with him, this idea of player development and develop him, and they think, we'll just throw the guy out there and let him play. That's how you develop. The best part about us right now is, for Modest, is we're in meaningful games, you know, in terms of trying to play after the end of the regular season. So instead of just going into the rest of the season with nothing on the line and we'll just give him minutes, that doesn't work. He needs to, you know, he hit a little bit of the rookie wall. He needed to figure out how to get through that. You know, he's gone through different things that he's needed to learn about how to improve. And I do think from a player development standpoint, yes, between the lines is important. But there's a lot of other things that impact what goes on in between the lines besides just playing time. And I give Modest a lot of credit that he's totally embraced that and has taken that on. I think as it relates to Josh Giddey, you know, Josh, I think coming in with leaving Australia, coming to the United States, playing in Oklahoma City, coming here, there was a lot of uncertainty, and he needed some period of time to adjust to the players he was playing with. And we've gone through a lot of injuries this year as well. But Josh, I think, has gotten into a situation where he really understands things that he needs to do to impact our group and help our team.
I think we've all been impressed by how you've been able to keep the focus on the main thing every night and not get caught up in all of the noise surrounding what this season represents to the Bulls. And I just wonder, in that context, Billy, with 10 games to go, after having a really successful 10-game stretch, 8-2, in that span, you kind of have changed things with the way that you've incorporated Herter, and Trey Jones was great before the injury, and Zach Collins has been a revelation. How has that changed or reset your goals for this season? Has it, if you in fact have played well enough to now kind of look at this season in a different way?
Yeah, there's no question those three guys coming in here helped our team immensely. Zach Collins has brought in a lot of physical toughness and size, rim protection. He's very, very good in pick and roll coverage. Herter is a really, really high IQ player. I really have always liked him as a player, even when he was in Atlanta and at Sacramento. He's got a really good feel how to play. He's more than just a catch and shoot guy. He can make plays and knows how to cut and read. He's very smart. And Trey Jones, I think I've been pretty outspoken about him. He just, there's a lot of things and intangible things he brings to the table. So I think with the way we were playing stylistically, those three guys fit in very, very well to how we were playing. And I think going forward, you know, the one thing, and I know a lot of people have a lot of different opinions of what we should or shouldn't do, you know, as it relates to the draft, free agency, I get that. But there's something really, really powerful in players that are younger. At some point in their career, they've got to impact winning. And even though, you know, where we're at right now as a team, you know, we're in the play-in, but we're still kind of at the bottom, you know, of the Eastern Conference. But the reality is we have a chance to play meaningful games, and that's going to help Modest. It's not just like, hey, the regular season's over with, we're not playing for anything, let's just roll him out there for 35 minutes and just see what the guy can do. And now what happens is the focus gets taken off the result of winning. Now, I think the results of winning are a byproduct of the things that you do for 48 minutes. And you've got to understand every possession's important. Paying attention to scouting reports are important. You know, the game plan discipline is important. So I think the one thing we've tried to do all season long is to make the point that all these games are important. And let's see what this group can do if we're fortunate enough after April 13th to be in a situation that we're playing after the regular season's over with. Those things are meaningful. That really, really plays a major factor, I think, in player development. And it also puts these guys in situations that they haven't been in before. And I think when you take the focus off of winning, you miss, I think, a big point of what's going to happen in the future. At some point, these guys are going to be put into a situation where now the winning becomes important. You want to make a run. And if they don't play in these meaningful games, I think it hurts their development. So what we've tried to do as a team, to your point of whatever the perception is of what or how the season should go, we in the locker room have kept it on, let's see how good we can be as a team. Let's go all in to become as good as we can be. And then whenever the season's finished up, hopefully it's something we can build upon going into the next season.
Great stuff, Billy. Really appreciate your time. Thanks for jumping on with us. And you're a really fun team to watch.
Yeah.
It's been
loads
of fun.
It really is enjoyable.
I really have enjoyed these guys. I appreciate the way they've worked and the way they've tried to play and sacrifice for one another. And, you know, we'll see how these next 10 games go, you know, come off a road trip, you know, playing tomorrow against the Lakers and then Dallas and back on the road again. So, you know, we've still got a lot of challenges in front of us, but hopefully we can continue to evolve and grow as a team.
Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it, Coach.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
That is Billy Donovan.
It shouldn't be easy. This should be hard. You know, the spring should be hard. Training camp should be hard. Anything worth doing is hard. So it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of effort. In particular, year one, we should not be comfortable as we're coming into the springtime. We're going to load these guys up. We're going to see what they can handle. We're going to fail, and that's okay. That's part of how you learn and how you grow and you get better. And so we're going to encourage that as a coaching staff. So nothing about this is about making it easier. So, yeah, it's going to be fun.
That's the gospel, according to Ben Johnson. We love hearing it. We welcome him. We also welcome our next guest. He is nice enough to join us in studio.
probably ran here, if we were being honest.
That's true. Neither Marshall nor I have ever met this man. Kidding. Clay Harbor. We know him well. He is the co-host of the Big Pro Football Show on CHSN, at ClayHarbs82 on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it. Also on Instagram as well. We'll get into the Clay Harbor fit side of this, I think, in the next segment.
I mean, it's part of your life, man, your legacy at this point.
Yeah, what are you talking about? You've only been working on this diligently for at least over a year. You're not going to share the fruits of your labor? That would be silly.
Yeah, it's around a year. And you're right, Marshall. I did run here. I grabbed a Saratoga Spring and a banana peel and some ice. And I put the Saratoga Spring water in the ice and I dunked my head in here as soon as I got in studio, just so I was ready for this show. All part of the routine.
Okay, I think, you know,
we got to address this now, right?
We do, because here's the thing. Typically, we'll be like, oh, sports first, fun stuff second. Both are ideal. But we just did the High Noon segment. Clay was just hanging out in here, because we're like, you might as well just hang out in the studio. Giggling is us talking about the one ring to rule them all and the matcha. But then we just started talking about the ridiculous morning routine. If you don't know, it's kind of hard to explain. Our friend Shakia Taylor just commented and reposted it, so that's a good way to get to it. Curly Fro on Twitter.
But also, if you just Google Ashton Hall, there's a billion videos, so his name articles, think pieces, everything.
Yeah, his name is Ashton Hall, and he's created this ridiculously aesthetic morning routine that centers around bottles of Saratoga water, which is, I think, somewhere, it's got to be at least like $3 or $4, I think, depending on the price, if not more per bottle. It's a big glass blue bottle, and it's taken the world by storm. And Marshall and I were like, well, we have to ask Clay about this, because if there's anybody who has a morning routine, it's got to be Clay.
Now, Ashton gets up at 4 a.m. and does this whole thing where he's rubbing a banana peel on his face.
I thought it was even earlier than that.
And he goes swimming. He does a lot of things in, I guess, 5 hours or something beforehand. And people are like, who is this guy? He's famous. He got 600 million views on all social media platforms combined over the last week. 600 million views. I want to really think about that.
That's more
Clay, how many times
population
did you watch the video? Be honest.
I told you guys, I watched it. Every time I see a spoof or the video, I can't help but watch it and just start dying laughing about this guy's morning routine. So I probably watched it 10 times.
Now, it came from a good place, though, because Ashton Hall, he actually played for Alcorn State in 2014 and 2015. He was a running back. In three games during the 2015 season, he had 6 rushing attempts for 8 yards. Those are his stats. He got depressed after college about not making it to the NFL, gained a bunch of weight, and then he went the other direction. We'll call it the Clay Harbor direction, because I don't know if you've ever seen the before and after pictures of Clay Harbor when he was an NFL tight end versus what he looks like now. Yeah, you've made improvements to your own life. So what is your morning routine, Clay? Let's just get this out of the way. What is your morning routine?
All right, morning routine. I wake up about 6:30. Grab some black coffee. I probably drink a couple sips. I don't try to finish a whole cup. I have Athletic Greens. I know we're not sponsored by them. Sorry, AG1.
We used to
be. Well, there you go. I drink some Athletic Greens, and I'll go to the gym. I'll get there about 7. I'll hit about 2.5 hours. I make sure to do cardio as soon as I walk in. Then I do strength training, and then I do the sauna and cold plunge after that. And then I get ready for my production call.
How long are those things?
30 minutes of sauna.
Okay.
30 minutes of cardio and like 1.5 hours of actually working out, stretch in the sauna, and then cold plunge after that, and then prep, because I'll get the rundown for the Big Pro Football Show, and then the production call, and then go into studio a little bit early, film some content, and that's pretty much the day.
So 3 hours at the gym, though. I just want to point out,
yeah,
I did the math.
At the gym.
Okay,
yeah.
3 hours at the gym.
So in the morning routine timestamp on the video, it's 7 through 10.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So wait a second. How are you programming the workout, though? Is it, what do you do each day per week? I am actually curious about that, because I do think that that is a handy tip for people who go to the gym.
So for me personally, because I've got so much time and experience, I'm actually a certified strength and conditioning coach. I'm a certified personal trainer. I studied this over the pandemic, and I got my certifications. Certified fitness coach as well. So I got 3 certifications from the ISSA. So for me, in my football career, 9 years in the NFL, going with working with the best strength trainers in the country, I kind of know what to do for my body each day I go in there, and I do a push-pull-leg split, which is basically push is chest, try, shoulders, pull, back and biceps, legs, obviously legs, but I do cardio with it every single day, and depending on how I'm feeling, the intensity I go, but that's how it works.
If you knew what you know now when you were in college, how much higher would you have been drafted, and how much longer would your NFL career have been?
Oh man, I'd have been first round pick. I think I should have been higher. I was fourth round pick from Missouri State. I think I would have been a maybe second round pick. Tight ends. Obviously, we got the Tyler Warren talk, the Colin talk. Could the Bears possibly take a tight end? I think they could.
At 10,
I think they could. I think Tyler Warren is just a weapon. The guy is incredible. He had 1,200 yards, 8 touchdowns. He was taking snaps from the Wildcat. This guy can do anything. You get Ben Johnson, a guy like him that you can line up anywhere. I love Tyler Warren, and I love Colston Loveland if you maybe traded back or traded up into the second round.
I just want to point out, 2 days in a row, we've had Tyler Warren be commented about, once by Mark Grody at noon yesterday, and now
Grody knows his stuff, man.
Yeah, Grody, we put him on the spot. He had not done a mock draft. I said, if you did a mock draft, we'll call this Grody 1.0. What are you doing? He said, Tyler Warren at number 10.
So, all right, here's why.
Talk me into it.
Why I like Tyler Warren, and I'm a little biased because I am a tight end.
I was about to say, that's obvious.
But the type of tight end that Tyler Warren is, he's a guy that can play inside, he can play outside. You look at I check his alignments. Slot, he's playing outside, XZ, he's playing inside attached. You bring him in with Cole Kmet. Cole Kmet can do all that too. People want Cole Kmet to have 70 catches. Guess how many targets he had last year?
Not 70.
55. Yeah. The guy ain't going to catch 70 balls with 55 targets. Guess who ran the third most 12 personnel, which is two tight end sets in the NFL last year?
The Detroit Lions,
Ben Johnson. They like to get two tight ends involved. If you have Tyler Warren and Cole Kmet that can catch and can block, Tyler Warren's a tight end. If you run nickel against him, he is going to block the nickel back out the stadium. He's the bouncer tossing the guy out the club. The nickel back can't guard Tyler Warren or Cole Kmet. Those guys can both block. If you try to line up a linebacker against him in base package and have the linebacker cover Warren or Cole Kmet, they're going to get open on the linebacker. So those are real mismatch guys. You got guys like Evan Engram, you got guys like even Colson Loveland. You can play those guys with a nickel because they're not powerful enough blockers to really create that mismatch. Tyler Warren changes that. They're going to be able to be so multiple in their formations and just confuse defenses if you have a guy like him on your team. So I wouldn't be opposed to it. I'm not saying that would be the number one thing, but if the board fell in a certain way where he was available and others weren't, I would be okay with Tyler Warren.
Yeah, because that's our concern, is the Jets have talked in the same glowing recommendation about him that you have, that Mark Grody has. They're sitting 3 spots higher at 7. And I feel like that might be the challenge, is when you know they love him as much as you do, and Mark Grody does, that might mean that he's off the board. You all seem to be on the same page for a good reason. I think one of the big ones I also have of this is we're talking about the makeup of the personnel. That thing, Clay, that we heard Ben Johnson talk about was the makeup, being able to do multiple things the defense doesn't know because you're good at both. How important do you think that is to consider when we look at this draft?
I think it's huge, right? You make the same things look different and the different things look same. And one way you do that is by staying in the same formation, right? You could be in 12 personnel. So the defense looks, they say they're in 12 personnel. Okay, they're going to pound the rock. Now you come out and you're in a wide formation, a split formation. So now maybe they play nickel to it, but then you go back in tight and now you have a mismatch in the running game and there's holes opened up. So a guy like Warren can do that for you. So that's where you get a tight end. And as far as, I know you want O-line, you want trenches. If Mason Graham, Mike Tannenbaum's mock draft to ESPN, the GM mock draft, he had Mason Graham falling to 10. If Mason Graham's at 10, scrap Tyler.
Well, you said he's not your number one, Tyler, but he is a guy that if he falls to you, that works. What is your number one?
I would say Mason Graham, if Mason Graham falls. I'm not sure I want to trade up for him. I mean, my number one would be Abdul Carter. I don't think Abdul Carter falls because of the foot. Maybe he falls to 5. You can trade both second-round picks. I think he is that good. He is Micah Parsons. I'm watching this guy as a tight end. I say, I don't want to block that guy. Say, please, I don't want to block that guy. And I'm a competitor. That's the guy I don't want to block. You know, watching these guys, these edge rushers, and I'm not sure there's another guy on the edge that really gives me those same feelings. I think Mike Green is a guy. I know he's got the off-field stuff, but he is an edge that people would think would maybe be a reach if they took him at 10. But I think Mike Green from Marshall, he had a little bit of off-the-field stuff, but yeah. But he led the nation in sacks, 17 sacks, pressures, was a top-three graded pro football focus run defender. This guy's great against the run and the pass, and it wouldn't be a reach if you took him at 10 if you were confident in what you got from him off the field either.
I do think that because we're so obsessed with offense, knowing that Ben Johnson is here, seeing what the Bears have done so far on their line, how they've addressed the offense, we probably are neglecting the defensive side. We talked about Graham, of course, but just the concept of them trying to do more on the line. When we even heard Ryan Poles talk about it, that's not going to just get filled by a guy like Grady Jarrett. They need more.
Oh, my gosh. The Bears, I like what they've done. They've improved on the line. Montez Sweat had 5.5 sacks last year. Yes, he had 12.5 the year before, but guess how many he's averaging throughout his career? 6.9 sacks per year. That's the guy you're getting. Montez Sweat is not a guy that can do it on his own. All right, Dio Odengbo, 3 sacks last year, 8 the year previous. Third guy, Austin. I mean, you're not sure you're missing him.
We'll see in terms
he's
of
got
anything else.
You need another. I thought they might bring one in the draft or in free agency, excuse me. So now I'm thinking they got to bring one in the draft in these top 39, 40, or 41 picks. You got 3 picks. One of them has to be an edge rusher that you're confident you can get some pressure on, because you need at least 4 good edge rushers, 1 go down, maybe 1 on each side. And as an offense, you know, when you are trying to prepare for multiple edge rushers, guys with different moves, with different skill set, it makes things different, because you gotta kind of change your game plan to the specific players that are on the field that have these different things that they're good at.
My question is this. When you look at the need of an edge rusher and the need to have their own guys on the offensive line, specifically at left tackle, which priority is higher for you right now for the Bears? An edge rusher or a left tackle?
An edge rusher. Once again, like, let's look at Montez Sweat. He's 8th highest average per year salary. We traded the 40th overall pick for him, which was Cooper DeJean. He was 60th in sacks last year, 55th in overall PFF grade, 40th in pass rush win percentage, and 35th in pressures with 32. That is not a top 10 guy. That is not a top 20 guy. You can argue he's a top 30, maybe 40. So you need an edge rusher. We don't got
a big
edge rusher.
So he's a plus edge rusher, but he's not. He's closer to middle of the pack than he is to
when
great.
I'm watching Montez Sweat, that's not a guy that I'm thinking is a tough block. You people like, oh, he's getting double teamed. He wasn't getting double teamed. He wasn't getting chipped. He wasn't a guy that you took a game plan and you had to plan against. I played against J.J. Watt. I played against DeMarcus Ware. I played against those guys that were saying, we are chipping him every single play, where you're changing your game plan to chip this guy. J.J. Watt, we got to have 4 hands on him on every single play. Played him twice a year, every year with Jacksonville. With the Eagles, DeMarcus Ware. Twice a year, everywhere. Montez Sweat isn't even in the vicinity of these types of players. I'm sorry. And Dio Odengbo, big, strong, long guy. What has he shown that he's going to get to the quarterback 10 times a year? He's not. So you need to find a guy. He's going to be a good player. He can stop the run. Dennis Allen loves long defenders. And I was with the Saints when Dennis Allen, in one draft, well, Dennis Allen, Sean Payton, we brought in Ryan Ramczyk, the Bengals.
Henderson?
Trey Hendrickson.
Yeah.
The Saints, Alvin Kamara. All in one draft, Marcus Williams.
Ooh, like, they had a haul.
A haul. I was there. All those rookies came in. So they had a good draft, and I think Dennis Allen bringing in Trey and them finding players there was impressive. So hopefully he can have a similar impact that he did when he was in New Orleans here in Chicago. And you saw that they were at the Michigan Pro Day, and maybe they were looking at a guy like Mason Graham.
I look at it like this. Basically, the Bears, right now, it's Christmas time. They're going to see Santa Claus Ryan Poles is Santa Claus, and you know Dennis Allen and Ben Johnson are getting with Santa Claus and tell him what they want under the tree, right? Because let's be honest, they're just as much involved in this process as Ryan Poles, the GM, is himself, because they need to tell him what they need. So I think it will be interesting to see which direction they go, specifically with that the first three picks. That's going to tell us a lot about how they see where they were before the draft and where their needs were.
You have four in the top 72, but there was something that I wanted to point out just overall as we talk about this. It's how many players you're having to replace for the last 3 years' drafts. Mm. And that's the issue. It's not just us talking about Montez Sweat. And essentially also in his contract, it's price per snap. When you consider it that way, because you know how you have to rotate him in and out, and the production that you see him have against teams that frankly at times were lesser opponents. Like, I felt like we kept waiting for something to happen with him so many times, and we saw him get close toward the end of the season on some closer to home, but that's not the production that he's getting paid for example. You mentioned Austin Booker. We're still trying to figure out what's going to go on with Jervon Dexter. We're still talking about all these players because there's a bigger picture we're having to address here, and they're running out of cap space.
Spiegel and Holmes show flashback.
Joe Buck. I don't know the inner workings of it, but I do know that my ultimate boss, Jimmy Pitaro, is a diehard baseball fan, is a baseball fan first, and is a Yankee fan. And Burke Magnus, who's his number two, and my other kind of big-time boss, is the same. So to think that ESPN is just going to go, oh, no, we're done, I just don't believe it. But that's just my opinion. I have no idea where this whole thing goes. And I think we're kind of, whether it's baseball or streaming with the NFL or, you know, all these different streamers that want to get into sports, we're at the Wild West time, kind of the precipice of all that. So where it all goes, I have absolutely no idea. But I do know that if the right deal was there for ESPN, and I would assume Major League Baseball, then that relationship would continue. I find it too hard to believe that there's not mutual interest on both sides.
That was our friend, mostly my friend, Joe Buck, on yesterday's show.
That hurts, Lawrence. Been friends with him for a decade, and yet you now are doing something for him, and you're stealing the friendship. I don't like it. I don't appreciate it.
We had a nice conversation with Joe about all sorts of things on yesterday's show, and we have been talking a lot about the relationship between ESPN and Major League Baseball. And I got to tell you, I have learned a lot by listening to David Sampson on the Sporting Class pod that he does with John Skipper and Pablo Torre. It is absolutely amazing. I can't recommend it enough. And then there's the Nothing Personal podcast that David Sampson does, too. He used to run the Marlins, so he understands a lot of this stuff, and he joins us now on the Circa Resort Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. David, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. I retweeted the episode where you and John Skipper kind of fell back into your old roles where you were representing baseball and he was representing ESPN. I'd love to know, as Rob Manfred, I think, echoed some of the things that you said on the podcast about the relationship between MLB and ESPN. How did you view what Manfred said? Because it seemed pretty much verbatim from what you were talking about.
Well, I lived it for 18 years. And one of the things about working with John Skipper, as I do now with Dan Le Batard and Metal Arc Media, is that I say to John, I don't think you realize that we're paying attention. We know where we are in the A block or B block on SportsCenter. We know when you move us off the main channel. We know exactly what you're doing with every sport because we keep track. And of course, John just deny. And that's fine. It makes for a good show. But as president of a team, I would be very frustrated doing that show. As the host of Nothing Personal, I was happy to do that show. So it was interesting as I sort of played two roles inside my brain.
What I don't get, David, is why the commissioner himself thinks it's a good idea to go on Mad Dog Radio and badmouth ESPN as a partner and accuse them of leaks and everything like that. Does that in any way serve his role and what baseball needs to do to either repair the relationship or even to move on? Does that serve his role at all?
Well, you sure as heck fire better have other deals in your pocket if you are going to do that. And if you have that feeling that you're able to replace the $550 million deal that just ended with ESPN, then by all means, have at it. There's nothing wrong with a little honesty once in a while to the media as commissioner, a little bit of information to the public saying, listen, everybody else is getting theirs. We want ours too. Now, of course, you'd prefer it not to happen around opening day and then have your own app not work on opening day, but let's not quibble about specifics.
MLB TV is down today on opening day, as David Sampson points out, and fans are livid. Even one member of the 40-man roster of the New York Mets, who's at AAA, was tweeting about how he can't watch his own team on opening day. That is, they used to be, David, the paragon of sports media. MLB Advanced Media was the standard, and other sports borrowed from them. Has that time passed? Are they woefully behind in that area now or not? Where do they stand?
No, I mean, I'm hoping it's just someone spilled a cup of coffee on a wire or something. I'd like to believe this is not sort of crazy thought that the technology is past MLB by and they don't know how to do it. And all of a sudden opening day happened and everything crashed. I'm going to assume that maybe a rat chewed through a wire or something. But no, the timing is not great, obviously. But that said, when you're thinking about a media relationship and you're thinking about how you're going to do your national deals and local deals moving forward, everything you do is with a purpose. Rob Manfred chose to speak with who he chose to speak with on purpose. He's very well trained. He's very much on message with all of his PR people led by Pat Courtney. So I have no qualms at all with what he did, what he said, and how he said it. It's important for ESPN to hear it.
David, it's interesting because the four of us here on this show, we're all like crazy baseball fans. We love the game and have loved the game since we were children. When I hear Rob Manfred talk, I understand the role that he plays as the negotiator, the guy that's keeping the peace between the owners, the haves and the have-nots, and everything else. I just wish that his people would get the friendlier version of him out in the public. I don't feel like he's always the best ambassador to the fans for the game. Does that matter at all?
Well, listen, I mean, if you put him next to Adam Silver, next to Roger Goodell, next to Gary Bettman, and you played pin the tail on the best PR guy, you'd put a blindfold on, you'd just see whatever tuchus you'd happen to touch. The fact of the matter is their main focus is on increasing the values of the team. Their main focus is labor and labor peace or labor war, whatever position you're in at the time. The front-facing part, it matters to us in the media, and fans are like, wow, I wish that we had someone from Central Casting who was easy on the eyes and spoken like haiku. But when we're voting on a commissioner the way I did in 2013, what he's going to look like and say to the media, it didn't even crack our top 20.
Okay. You had mentioned something on the Nothing Personal podcast about Cubs-Dodgers that I wasn't equipped to articulate. How much money did Major League Baseball make, and how well did they set themselves up for future streaming deals internationally?
So that really is the point of sending the Dodgers and Ohtani against the Cubs, where you just are able to have an all-Japanese matchup in game one. Rob Manfred came out and said, we're looking at like $35 million in revenue. That compares to an all-star game. And that's amazing when you're going out and trying to sell your rights. And the way it was 25 years ago is there would be a little bit of international broadcast rights. It was over the air in different countries. It wasn't very much money. Now you're talking about international streamers like an Apple or a Netflix or an Amazon, where if you cut a deal, you're not just cutting a deal in the US, you can cut a deal for worldwide rights. And that's extremely powerful. And that's why it makes such financial sense to grow the game in Asia. We complained, I don't know if you were annoyed in Chicago at the 5 a.m. start, but I have a surprise for you. MLB didn't care about the fans in Chicago. Those games were solely focused on Asia, where it was a 7 o'clock start in Tokyo.
Yeah, we knew it wasn't about us. I mean, we actually enjoyed it.
We enjoyed being able to
wake up and watch baseball, and some of our listeners just driving in to work and listening to the broadcast of the Cubs right here on The Score. It was all right. We're talking with David Sampson right now on 670 The Score. Hey, David, 22 of the 30 teams lowered payroll this season. And there are 14 teams that spent less than $45 million. This is an industry that generated $12 billion last year. So would the sport be a better product for the fans is really my question. If there was a salary cap and a salary floor, like every other sport, would it be a better product for the fans, in your opinion?
You know, it's interesting. It's being talked about now by the union. You have Andrew Miller out giving interviews about this. You've got owners like the owner in Baltimore and Colorado talking about the need for a cap and a floor. I would just ask you, let's talk about the NBA. There are teams tanking in the NBA every single year. In the NFL, there are teams tanking every single year. There's good teams, there's bad teams. What a cap and a floor do is, in theory, they squeeze the bottom up toward the middle and they stop the top from being runaway trains. Other than that, there's a premium on intelligence and smart decisions and good front offices and then good play by your players. So for me, the reason why I would like a cap is that I'd like to believe as a team president that I'm just as smart as the Dodgers. So if I had the resources that the Dodgers had or not such a huge gulf, that I would be able to beat them 5 out of 10 times. Because that's pretty much what you're asking for, is you want a chance to be 50% successful. And so the question is, how big a fight are you willing to have over a cap and a floor? And the owners right now can't even argue to the union about a cap and a floor because they're arguing amongst themselves because of the great disparity between the top and bottom payroll. And the Dodgers, Yankees, Mets, they don't want Cubs. They don't want to fund the Marlins, the A's, and the Rays payroll any more than they already do in current revenue sharing rules. So the first step, guys, and why I'm worried about a stoppage after 2026 is the owners have to get their act together before they can even get to arguing with the players.
Yeah, every owner will take shots at the Pirates, you know? Like, every owner, because the problem with the comp to other leagues where there's tanking is that there's clearly MLB teams who are pretending to tank in terms of a rebuild, but they're just hanging around at the bottom, taking revenue sharing and not actually doing what they need to do to get better. That's unique to baseball.
That's actually not true, though. I'll push back a little bit. I ran a team that struggled at payroll for 18 years. Some years we went much higher and irresponsibly trying to get a winner. Some years we broke it down. It's a cycle, and you try to get your open window and have your open window last as long as possible where you can compete. But teams, look at the Cubs. The Cubs went through a stretch where they were rebuilding and they were tanking in theory, and then they built up to a World Series, then down. And their downs in Chicago should be smaller and last a shorter number of years than our downs in Miami, as an example. But every team is going to have that. So I really don't think that what Bob Nutting is doing in Pittsburgh, as an example, he's not putting money in his pockets. It is so misleading to think that, oh, you get $70 million in revenue sharing, therefore you should have a $70 million payroll. Or you have $70 million in ticket revenue plus revenue sharing. Why isn't your payroll $140 million? Well, I ran a team. There are tens of millions of dollars of expenses that people don't focus on that are overhead to running a baseball team. So while Bob Nutting has a problem in that, he's not winning. It's not that he can't win with the payroll he has. Look at the playoff teams last year. Guardians. Look at how good this year you're going to see the Royals again and the Tigers. So, and the Rays have been, wait a minute.
Yes,
since
absolutely.
2008, the Rays have, I think, the third best record in all of baseball, and their payroll is always at the bottom. So I think that we need to take a better look at whether or not people running these teams are good, not whether or not they're purposefully not trying to be.
David, last year I talked with a high-ranking MLB official about the RSN issue,
and the money that is being lost. And the quote from this official was bloodbath, and talking about the ownership maybe starting to ask for that money back from the players, which is another reason why we could see a stoppage after next season. In Chicago right now, the Comcast situation with the White Sox, their games are not on in almost a million households in Chicago, and I don't think Comcast is going to blink. They didn't blink in some of the other baseball markets over the past couple of years. How bad is this situation, and is there a remedy to it?
They can't blink, and it's happening in New York also with the Yankees. So it's not about how crappy your team is or what kind of city you're in. It's about the reality of people no longer wanting to buy a cable package that pays for channels that they don't watch. And in the old days, when the money was flowing like water from a waterfall in Niagara Falls, that was because millions of people every month were paying a cable bill that included channels that they didn't care about. And what the cable companies did is they then gave that money to the regional sports networks, who then gave that money to the teams. And it was such a great symbiotic relationship until people started cutting the cord. And people started saying, I don't really want to pay for Fox Sports Florida or FanDuel Florida. And Comcast said, well, if you don't want to pay for it, here's what we'll do. We'll put it on a special tier that if you want it, then you pay extra to get it. But if you don't want it, it's like a tier. If you don't want it, then you don't have to have it. And then everyone realized, well, wait a minute, not as many people want it. Therefore, the money stopped flowing, and now it's beginning to impact players. Now, remember, you can't take money away from guaranteed contracts. What you can do is lower payrolls, and that's what teams are doing because their revenues are going down. In a cap world, by the way, caps are related to revenue. If revenue goes down, payrolls go down. If revenue goes up, payrolls go up. So this is a very normal thing that's happening in baseball.
So David Sampson is a tremendous resource for the very important but sometimes joyless conversation that is the finances of baseball. Let me tap into baseball fan David here on opening day.
Yes,
what are you looking,
please.
What are you looking forward to on the field this year? Give us something you're really looking forward, a team, a player, whatever you want. Your dime, your dance floor, David Sampson.
I must say that, and this is not because I'm with you in Chicago, and I've been talking about this on Nothing Personal, the addition of Kyle Tucker to the Cubs is probably the second most meaningful offseason transaction via trade, with Crochet going to the Red Sox as the number one. So Chicago's right in the middle, and of course it makes sense. The White Sox send, the Cubs receive. I wouldn't worry about Cam Smith becoming this Hall of Famer. The fact is, you have a producing middle of the lineup, well above average player. So there's so much excitement in Chicago, and I happen to love it when the Cubs are good, but I'm also sort of a train wreck guy. I don't think the White Sox will lose 121 games, but it's going to be fun for me to watch them try.
David, we really appreciate the time. I love the Sporting Class is one of my favorite podcasts, and Nothing Personal is awesome as well. I love the movie previews and the movie recommendations. Thanks so much for your time. Let's talk again soon.
David, thanks for balancing the joy with the joylessness beautifully. We appreciate
it. Have a great day. See you guys later.
That's David Sampson. I really highly, like, if you're someone that wants to learn about some of the nooks and crannies of how sports business works, the conversations between David Sampson and John Skipper are elite.
That's awesome. Yeah, and we'll have a couple years here to debate the cap and the cap floor and what's going to happen, because there's a lot of teams. He's totally right that the owners have to get their acts together. They have to find some unity.
They do.
And I don't know if Rob Manfred can guide them there.
And all I know is that when I talked with that MLB official, and then I, you know, because I was, Dan and I had Ian on, and Ian was a player rep, and we talked with him about it. He's like, well, they better buckle up. They better buckle up if it's going to be a bloodbath. So the people who are doomsaying when it comes to baseball maybe going away, I understand it completely, that we could definitely have a work stoppage because of how dug in and how innate the problems of baseball are right now. They've got so much work to do on a bunch of different fronts.
At the top of the hour, a flat-out baseball legend and Hall of Famer, maybe the best ever to do his job in baseball talked to our guy Shane Reardon. So we'll get to that at the top of the hour. But Lawrence, can we talk about a coaching hire for the Chicago Bears that I think people ought to be excited about? Can we touch on the football just a hair?
Sure, we can do all of that next here on The Score.
Brad Biggs. Biggs time.
Biggs.
With Mully and Haw.
Biggs time.
The Biggs Report.
With Brad Biggs.
Biggs time.
Biggsy.
His name is Brad Biggs.
Brad Biggs talks football with you.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. Brad Biggs is the football man of the Chicago Tribune, longtime contributor to the station and a valued and well-loved friend. And he joins us on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, Aturo.com. Biggs A!
Morning, Brad.
Morning, boys. What's going on?
Well, you're very popular, and like you have a texter saying quite literally, I laugh out loud every time you play the Robot Biggs, and you know, compliments on everything you do. Can you ask Biggsy what happened to his Missouri Tigers in the NCAA tournament? People know too much about you.
Yeah, they were bad the last couple of weeks. I watched a couple minutes of the game. That was it. You know, they were so bad to the finish line this season that had no expectations, but to go from winless in the SEC a year ago to making the tournament, that's fine. We'll move on.
We will move on. So Brad, obviously we're reading your draft and we're going over 1.0, and let's be honest about it. The reality is that's your first bite at the apple, right? How many drafts will you do? You will do one right before the draft in April. I know that.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be a couple more, at least two more, probably, on. I mean, one guy texts me, he's like, hey, you get, is this based on something you know?
You know stuff, Brad? Does that mean you know stuff?
I'm like, blind guess, bro. Blind guess.
But, Brad, I think it's interesting though because you have Will Campbell going to the Bears at 10, and I'm curious, like, based on the people you talk to around the league, is there a building consensus that the first tackle off the board will be Armon Membu from Missouri because of the way he tested and just because of how he has begun to rise?
I think there's a couple factors that go in there. Like Membu, I don't think you can play him at left tackle.
Right,
and I don't think you'd probably want to try. Like, I remember talking to people about him back in, late September, early October. They liked him. They wanted to look at him some more. They thought he might be a guard. Now, I think people feel pretty good about him playing right tackle. But I think it depends a little bit what you need. Like, if you need two tackles, you could take him and plug him in there. But he's popular right now, and as one GM told me at the combine, he said that offensive linemen in the draft in round one aren't much different than quarterbacks from the standpoint that they get overdrafted because everybody needs them. Like, of the 32 teams right now, how many are sitting there and they're saying, oh, yeah, we're good on the O-line? That's a small handful of teams going into the draft every year, whether they actively try to get one in the first couple rounds. That's not always the case, but everybody is always hunting offensive linemen.
Yeah, there's truth in that, and the Bears could, obviously you want them to keep going. I wonder, is it fair to ask if Will Campbell can play left tackle in the NFL?
That's a good question, and it's a fair question, and people have said, well, what about the arm length? And
right.
Fair question, right? But, boy, you watch him do it at LSU, and it sure looks like he can do it, right? We're not you're not projecting a guy from a small conference that played, had a big game against Mississippi State, and then they played Rutgers, and those were the two big teams on the schedule that they played. This is a guy who played at an elite level for a while. He's not a one-year starter. So I think if you're drafting him, chances are you're starting him at left tackle, and you see what it looks like anyway, right? And,
right. You would have to do that if you take him
at
10.
And it's like in a lot of these people that talk about, his arm length is an issue, are ignoring the fact that there's been some pretty damn good linemen with shorter arms than you would like that have played left tackle in the last, 20 or 30 years in the NFL.
I tend to agree with that, Brad. I think it's an interesting choice, and if he fell to them, they'd be lucky probably to draft him. I also wonder this. In your mock draft, you have Ashton Jeanty going 12 to the Cowboys. How difficult, if that is indeed the case, would it be in your mind, based on who you've talked to, for Ben Johnson to pass on a running back that would give him a dynamic weapon in the backfield?
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend to know how Ben Johnson feels about Jeanty or his desire to build up that position, but that's got to come down to a number of factors. One, how special is this guy? There's a little bit of recency bias here because, folks are, this is the greatest running back that's come along in a long, long time. He's a really good player. There's no question about that. I would think the loud and proud crowd that wanted them to focus on the offensive line in the off season would probably want them to stick with that in the draft, right? Yep. Or do we have some flip meet flop where they're going to change their tune, and then if the line isn't fixed for the long haul, they're going to be back again saying these people were idiots that everybody knew they needed to fix the line, because Drew Dolman looks like a guy who can take care of your center position for this season and hopefully quite a while to come. Tooney, that's a shorter term fix,
yes.
And Jonah Jackson, they've got a lot of faith in, and if you're believing in the coach, you're trusting him there. But he needs to bounce back, and you've got the question mark at left tackle. So you can't go wrong continuing to build the line. The Lions didn't get their fancy toy at the running back position until they had, really built up the structure and the backbone of that roster.
That's a good way of putting it. And I, as I have said many times, I have no problem drafting line of scrimmage at number 10, at 39, at 41. And maybe not all offensive linemen, but there are two sides to the line of scrimmage. I know they've improved through free agency, but I don't believe they're done there either.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is that gets lost in this discussion about Jeanty at 10 that I think some people just kind of ignore. It's a fantastic draft for running backs. It's not a good draft for running backs. It's a great draft. So that being said, are you at the point in your program where you can take a running back 10th overall, where you can draft a running back in the first round for the first time since Cedric Benson, which was two decades ago? Are they at that point in their program? I don't know that a foray in a free agency, understanding that they've got some players with really strong track records, high marks on the field, in the locker room, but we tend to get kind of blinded by some of these moves in free agency where we expect them in March and April to be more impactful than they wind up being in October and November. So are they at that point where they can pull the trigger on a running back that high in the draft?
Brad, I love the top 10, but very curious. The same question kind of applies to Tyler Warren, who you have going 7 to the Jets. That's very high for a tight end unless you're convinced that he's one of these guys that makes your offense instantly dangerous.
Yeah, I think Tyler Warren's interesting because he can impact every down, right? Like he's fantastic in the passing game. He's going to do everything. He's called upon and more in the running game. I mean, he's a guy you can't dismiss from any conversation about the Bears at number 10, right? Because he's that total package at the tight end position, which I think is kind of, you know, what the Bears like. I think they'll get away from, you know, going for this one-dimensional guy, a Jimmy Graham type, a Gerald Everett, guys of that type. I think they're looking for players that can do it all. And, you know, I don't know what the chances are would be for him, but you'd need to have a conversation about him at 10. I think he's a really good player. Hmm.
You know, I don't think it's for 10, but whoever winds up with Omarion Hampton, it's like you're drafting Derrick Henry. I mean, you see the size of this guy and the athletic ability and the strength. I mean, he's like a man.
Wow. Yeah, he probably goes round one.
Yes.
Like that's your second running back that's taken. And, you know, maybe the Bears are looking at him in a scenario and where there's a trade down.
Right.
I think they probably need to resist the urge to trade up with these three. You're in a really good spot right here.
You don't want to trade up, right? Picks.
Yeah. Well, you got three picks in the top 41.
Yes.
Just, be confident in the process you've put in place to stack your draft board, right, and arrange it. And then attack it, right? And then go get it, and keep your draft capital where it's at.
Brad, I just wonder if you're attaching any significance to the fact that Ben Johnson shows up at a Hawks game and they score a touchdown and win 7-4.
He did. He had
instant offense.
Dave, yeah. The Hawks are totally irrelevant, brother. Oh, that's
nice.
They're completely irrelevant.
Excellent.
They won last. Response. They won yesterday, Brad. Bedard's hot.
Win, lose, or draw, they are irrelevant.
Ben Johnson begs to differ, and he was there. He was there. All right, good stuff, Biggsy.
Yeah.
Love the mock draft.
Good talking to you, buddy. The mock draft is tons of fun. I wonder if more quarterbacks will be taken than you imagine. You know, there's a lot of talk about Jackson Dart moving up. You know, no one would have picked Denver to jump in and take their quarterback, and it happened. And I think there could be a run on the bank, as we always know. Everybody needs a quarterback.
The Steelers need to get involved somehow because they're still trying to move on from Ben Roethlisberger, and maybe Aaron Rodgers lands there. But even if Rodgers does, you've got to
there is next
you've got to
year.
Come up with a solution. Yeah. For that position.
There's always a year after you get a 40-year-old quarterback. Great stuff, Big Z.
See, Brad.
If Rodgers goes to the Steelers, the Bears do have Pittsburgh on the schedule this season.
Yeah, they come to town, I believe.
And have a great day, guys.
He owns them.
He owns them.
Well, he may not own them.
Anymore?
I don't know. Not with that group. Maybe.
Maybe just.
He'll make the Steelers better if he goes there.
He would.
He would make the Steelers
they need a
definitely feel like they have a chance to return to the playoffs.
We're back with more of the Spiegel and Holmes Show, live from Stadium Swim, inside Circa Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book, on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Sometimes I get a good feeling.
In about 10 minutes, we are going to talk with Cubs President Jed Hoyer. We'll get his thoughts as his team opens up domestically. Obviously, starting the season 0-2 after the first two games in Japan. They will play the Diamondbacks tonight. You will be able to hear that game and all Cubs games here on The Score. Spiegs, the roster has now been finalized for domestic opening day for the Cubs. What do you think?
I think that it's a pretty good team. I think that offensively they should be better than last year, and they were actually pretty good last year. I think that, as we suspected early on, the bottom of the roster is a hell of a lot better than it was last year, and that's going to matter because dudes will play. John Birdie as your veteran utility guy who could start all over the infield is a hell of a lot better than Miles Mastroboni or Nick Madrigal. I think Vidal Brujan is more toolsy than those guys. I think Gage Workman is a very interesting lefty power bat that they're keeping, as for right now, as a Rule 5 draft pick from the Tigers. It depends. If PCA and Miguel Amaya are the guys that they looked like in the last 6 to 8 weeks of the season, that is improvement that's built in. And I happen to think that Dansby Swanson is going to take a step forward. But those are kind of theoreticals. So really, Kyle Tucker swapped in for Cody Bellinger is an upgrade, is a serious offensive upgrade. And so that is the biggest principal upgrade, is that one right there. And then the rest are kind of some offensive theoreticals and some steps forward. And there's a lot of options for who you think is going to take those steps forward offensively. And I think there are several, some of whom I've given you. But Kyle Tucker is the principal presence that's been added in exchange for Cody Bellinger. And that in and of itself does make them better offensively.
I agree with you. I think that they are a better team than what we saw last year. It was interesting, like, going through John Greenberg's piece in The Athletic with Jed and him talking a little bit about, hey, you know, you got to outperform the numbers and the projections. It's a little scary for any Cubs fan to hear that, because I feel like they've been living in this space of, instead of the roster being constructed to win 90 games, is you have to kind of hope and pray that some of this stuff happens, that Dansby Swanson isn't injured this year, and that he does give you some offensive thump that you're looking for in your lineup.
Yeah, you know, Craig Counsell famously directed his comments towards exactly that, towards the end of last year. And Tyler Farengol, who's running the board for us back at the shop, has Craig Counsell in the final week of the season talking about what the Cubs should be doing in the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, we got to get better, man. Like, the team we're chasing is 10 games ahead of us. You got to get better. And we should try to be building 90-win teams here. I mean, you know, like, that's like what you have to do to, you know, that's a playoff standard. I mean, that's what you got to get to be safely in the playoffs, right? And safely in the tournament. So from that perspective, you know, we got a ways to go.
Okay, so then we sat down with him at Cubs convention. It wasn't memorable for him. It was for us. And we asked him about whether or not he feels like the roster for the Cubs is closer to that 90-win mark.
Last week of the year, when you said we should be in the business of building 90-win teams, the we was doing a lot of work there, because, like, I kind of sat here like, hey, do you feel like Jed and Carter built you a 90-win team? That's not really a fair question, because you're part of it. Do you feel like you guys have built a 90-win team, or do you feel like by opening day you will have built a 90-win team?
Yeah, I mean, that I think we've got work to do still, and we're going to try to get there. Absolutely. I mean, that's and 90 win is it's I'm using that as a number. That's the playoff number. You know, it's not the it doesn't necessarily, but it's a playoff number, right? It's the playoffs, and that's what it takes to. And I think it takes a team like that to really compete at the World Series level. And so that's what I absolutely think the standard should be. It should be the expectation, and we should run from that.
So between that interview, Lawrence, and right now where we are, they added Gage Workman. And they added, I think, Carson Kelly. I believe that signing came after the convention, if I remember correctly. And not a whole lot. I guess Ryan Pressly. They added Ryan Pressly. So, and we
which
have
I think is a really strong move.
It is a very strong move. It is a very strong move, and that bullpen is deeper. I think Eli Morgan, who does make the opening day roster from Cleveland, was added after that conversation. So there are a few different additions. What there wasn't was an Alex Bregman, which would have, I think, sealed the deal. I think they'd be projected by just about everybody as a 90-win team if Bregman was your starting third baseman and Matt Shaw was either in AAA or was taking the Vidal Brujan backup depth spot, but he's not.
So to you, does it feel like, how would you describe what their chances are just from looking at the roster to win the division?
I think they've got a really, really good chance to win the division. I bet them as an over. I bet they're 85.5 as an over. I did think about everything else in the division, but it's an unbalanced schedule, it's a more balanced schedule, not the old unbalanced schedule. Instead of 19 games against the Pirates, now they get 13. So that makes a big difference. Two fewer series against the dregs of your division.
A team that's not trying at all.
But I must admit that them being the favorite to win the division has a pretty big component of the Cardinals stink. The Pirates are really bad. The Reds haven't quite done enough, in my mind. And the Brewers did not really add much offense. Now, the Brewers and the Reds could be better. And some people are picking those teams to be better. But I still think the Cubs are better right now.
Yeah, and look, I do think that if you're trying to project out as someone who runs a team,
yeah,
the ideal situation is that you're building no matter what. That you're trying to build a winner no matter what. And I get that there are going to be some financial limitations compared to teams like the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Padres occasionally that are going to make it difficult for Jed to do that the way that maybe he would like. The Cubs don't really do deferred money.
Even though they did, Jason Hayward's still making $5 million this year.
Right. But and that's a bank account that they're not willing to open up just yet. And that's what they figured out from a business standpoint, and so whatever. The secondary way to then go about it is, well, how does our division look? And what can we do that will make us competitive enough that we can make this spicy when August and September come around? I think it was a big step for Jed Hoyer to pull the trigger on the Kyle Tucker move. And it could blow up in his face. It really could if Cam Smith is good for a long time. And then at the end of this, Kyle Tucker ends up walking.
Yeah, if he's a one and done, that'll blow up in his face. But I'll tell you, he addresses it in the Q&A with Greenberg that you mentioned in The Athletic, that a lot of organizations have an eye on this possible impending work stoppage after, you know, the next two seasons. And that is behind the thought process of a lot of moves for a lot of different organizations.
And I got to tell you that I hate that.
Yeah, I know. You should.
I hate that because I feel like, you know, and
sucks.
Theo's brought it up a long time ago, like the idea of every season being precious and your opportunity to win the next World Series.
Right.
I kind of wish that some of these guys would look at it as, all right, who knows what the environment is going to look like once we get things straightened out from a work stoppage standpoint. Let's go right bleeping now.
Sure, and that might be the case in the offseason. There's a chance that they do sign Kyle Tucker after the season, you know, and that he will have been impressed and they will have, you know, fallen for him and they decide to invest. And I've had people within the organization tell me that some of the Bregman money decisions were about making sure that they can do Tucker, who they think is a better long-term investment. And I agree with that. So, but are they just kicking the can down the road? Are they just selling me a bill of goods when they say that? That is certainly open to interpretation. Or do they have a desire to do that? We'll have to see. And can I tell you, can I ask you, Lawrence, like, I love Terry Francona. That's my favorite living manager. That is my number one favorite living manager. And there's various reasons. One of them is I know the job he did after Cleveland fell apart at the beginning of the 2017 season the same way the Cubs did. I know from people inside what he did to attack that Cleveland slump. And if people don't remember, they won, 23 in a row down the stretch of 2017 after having a World Series hangover and having a bad first half that year. Like, he is an active and attentive, strong manager with personalities. So I love what he's going to bring to Cincinnati. And there's other reasons I love Terry Francona, but I just don't see it with that team. They're a very popular pick. They're a super popular pick. I saw Tom Verducci picked him. There's a ton of baseball experts who are picking Cleveland. Cleveland, Cincinnati to win that division. And I just don't see enough on the field to merit that.
I don't see it either. And you know that that's been one of the places where I would like to see Luis Robert be traded to. I feel like that would help them. And it addresses a need that they have.
They need another outfield bat, without a doubt.
And he plays great defense when he's healthy. So, whatever. I agree with you on Tito like being one of the more important managers over the last 30 years in baseball.
And he's just my favorite. You know, like,
it's fun.
And that stuff in the comeback, you watch the comeback on Netflix, I mean, about the Red Sox. There's a moment where David Ortiz has been struggling, and he's at the batting cage, and he's really scuffling, and Terry Francona's sitting there watching him, and Ortiz is getting angrier and angrier, thinking that Tito sees something. He's not saying it. So he turns around, he says to Tito, what do you see? I know I'm scuffling. You probably see something. Fine. What do you see? And Terry says, me? I'm just staring into space. Hey, big guy, I hit 210. I hit 210. You're David Ortiz. You figure it out. And Ortiz laughed his ass off, and, like, he said something unlocked right then. He's like, oh, yeah, I can figure it out, because Terry's humble, man. He knows he didn't know how to do it like these guys did. So, like, stories like that, there's tons of stories about him helping guys relax and be the best version of themselves.
I think the Cubs have a manager that's got some of that in him right now.
Yes,
I think that totally Craig Counsell agree. is a player's manager in the sense that he understands what they're going through.
You bet.
He can speak to a lot of this stuff.
Yeah,
that's going to happen to them day to day.
I can't wait to watch the job that Craig Counsell does this year. Cannot wait. I'm expecting a lot. I'm sure Jed Hoyer's expecting a lot.
I am too, and it's because now I am going to give grace for the idea of, let me get in there and see how all of this works. And I think that was kind of what Craig Counsell was doing last year, along with, you know, obviously managing the team. But let me get out in here and see how I work with Jed and Carter.
Let me see how their systems work. Let me see what ways they do certain things.
How they view stuff.
Yeah.
Like what the scouts think about players and how different that might be from what I think about the players.
What information they value as opposed to what I value. And if there's things that I can change around. And I'm sure that he came across things he wanted to change. And I hope he's had a chance to change those things and assert himself in a new way. And he'll need to. For this team to do what it has to do, they're going to have to outperform some expectations, Jed Hoyer. And do what they do.
And that's not fun. I mean, I am known for the viral, you know, bully these hoes when it comes to the National League Central. And that's how I feel about it, that the Cubs should be in a financial position to really take advantage of. And I keep being astounded by how bad things are for the Cardinals organizationally, because organizationally they have been really, really strong. So to see them, like, it's like, here you go, the evil empire, the beast is wounded.
It's an interesting moment in this division, and that's why the Cubs are the favorites. One of the reasons that the Cubs are the favorites, and we're pleased on the Spiegel and Holmes show right now to bring in Jed Hoyer, the president of baseball operations. He joins us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. Jed, thanks for your time. How you doing, sir?
I'm good. How you guys doing?
We're good, man. We were just talking about Craig Counsell and what it's going to be like to watch him do his job in year number two. Are you looking forward to seeing him do his job now that he's comfortable with everything and either knows everybody or played a part in the acquisition of some of the new guys?
Yeah, I think comfortable is a great word for it. I think that, you know, last year, you know, it's just kind of drinking from the fire hose, trying to learn all these different personalities, trying to learn a new place. And, you know, I think, you know, different coaching staff, et cetera. I think that now, you know, just a comfort, to use your word, that he had in spring training all off season is very different. So yeah, I'm excited about it. I think it's hard to come into a new place like that, and especially come in and not have all your own people. So yeah, I think he's looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm excited about it.
Jed, what was the value of the Japan trip for the Cubs specifically? I get what it did for baseball, but for the Cubs specifically, what was the value, and what, if any, do you worry about being that you're really only about a week removed from that trip?
Well, I guess that's the kind of thing we just can't worry about. You just don't know, right? You don't know how it's going to affect you, and there's no point in being concerned. You've done everything we can do to sort of rest guys, get everyone ready. But as far as the value, I think the value is immeasurable. I think that, you know, forcing the team to be together really for a week in a foreign country, I think that was an awesome cultural experience. I think it was incredible for them to just to feel the energy that was there. I mean, it felt like two World Series games, but also like the bonding, you know, those are all, you know, probably 20 meals are eaten with the team together that wouldn't be eaten together if we were in spring training. And so I think it's just a different experience. I mean, talking to guys from the Padres and Dodgers for last year, they really felt like it helped them with their bonding as a team, getting everyone together earlier. And I think we'll feel the same thing.
Hey, Jed, I like this team. I like the depth. I like the back of the bullpen. Both of those things much more than last year on opening day. But would you say that you've built a 90-win team at this point?
Unclear. I mean, I think there's projection systems that say yes. There's projection systems that say no. I mean, ultimately, I think the beauty of this game is, you know, we need to go out and every day as an organization, from front office to coaching staff to players, like, we need to try to exceed expectations and we need to optimize our performance. And that's really, to me, opening day is it's the first tee shot off the tee box. It's the, you know, it's the first game of the season, and it sort of signals that baseball is back. But ultimately for me, it's just, okay, this is the journey and we need to, as a group, we need to outperform. And that goes really for everybody in the league, right? I think if we outperform, I think that we have a chance to be that 90 win team you're talking about, to, you know, feel like we're a really deep, solid team. I think, but every team in baseball, I think, is looking to outperform and to get the best out of their guys. And, you know, that's what starts today.
To get back to the word comfort, have you ever had a roster going into a season where you're like, you know what, I might not say it publicly, but I know that we're going to be good, and then they were good, and I'm curious on how uncomfortable it is when you do have a roster, you're like, well, this guy might have to play over what we expect or what the projections are for this player.
Yeah, very rarely, to be candid. I mean, a couple times here, maybe in 16 and 17, just felt like we were a cut above the rest of the league, honestly. You know, I think going into that season, I mean, we definitely felt that going into 16, and I think we won 9 more games than anyone else in baseball. And, you know, really in Boston, never, I would say. The Yankees were, at all times, were so daunting at that point that you could never go in feeling that way. So, yeah, maybe once or twice. But I think the nature of the game and these jobs is that, you know, things are going to happen. It's such a long season, and I try to tell myself that on opening day every year. Things are going to happen unexpectedly bad, and things are going to happen unexpectedly good. And I think that, like, our job is to just never stop trying to improve the team, never stop, you know, never feel comfortable. Because I don't think, to answer your question, like, I don't think you ever feel comfortable. I don't think you ever should. And, you know, we're going to spend, you know, the next 6 months just trying to get a little better every day and trying to look for ways to improve, you know, off the roster if we need to.
Hey, Jed, I think if you guys are anywhere near 500 on May 12th, it bodes really well. You know, like, that's after a series at the Mets, and then there's a theoretical break in the schedule. It is brutal. Will you look at that? If you're 20-22 after 42 games, how do you think you're going to feel?
Yeah, no, I mean, I never really thought about it, like, lines of demarcation, so to speak. But I do think, yeah, it's a bear of a schedule early. You know, trying to look at it, you know, glass half full, that I think that's a good challenge for us. We're getting a lot of West Coast trips out of the way early, a lot of tough teams out of the way early, and we're going to find out a lot about ourselves quickly. You know, we're definitely going to be stress tested early. But there is a danger. You know, I felt that way a little bit last April, not quite as hard a schedule, but I think we were 16-9 or something like that, and then we struggled when we actually got into a little bit easier part of our schedule. So ultimately, yes, it's very hard to string long winning streaks together when you're playing teams like we are early. But if you're playing well, you win games. If you're not playing well, you lose. And I think the way baseball is set up now, there's really only a handful of teams that are, like, kind of rebuilding. And so I feel like, you know, almost every series is a test now. And I think that's really good for baseball in general.
Hey, how is the change in the schedule from unbalanced to more balanced, where you lose 2 series with each of your division opponents? How has that changed the way you guys do your internal projections?
Well, yeah, it's just, you know, I do think that I think it's way better for baseball, way better. I think that, you know, when you're playing you know, your division, you know, 18, six series, 18 times. It felt like too much, honestly. It felt like we were constantly playing the same teams. And I think from a fan standpoint, this is immeasurably better. But yeah, there's sort of fewer, there's just fewer series head to head to control your destiny. So I do think that makes it a little harder that way. You're going to have to play well against everybody. But I do think it's just better for the game. I mean, it's great to know that you're going to play every team every year. I think there's real value in that from an industry standpoint. And frankly, from a fairness standpoint too, I think that this makes a lot more sense.
Jed, how do you keep, I'm trying to think of the right way to phrase this. How do you keep from being jealous of what maybe the Dodgers and Mets have while looking at your own situation and say, no matter what it is they have, we have to figure out a way to compete? How do you not allow for what other teams are doing to steal some of the joy of trying to to build a winning baseball team?
I don't know. I guess, I mean, it's my life, right? I think that when I drive to the lakes, you know, Sheridan to head down to work some days, like, do I stop and get jealous and unable to complete my day looking at some of the houses on the water? Like, no, I don't. You got to do the best you can with what you have. And I think that's the job, right? You can't get jealous of everyone else. You know, they have their own challenges and own problems. And I think, just knowing, you know, we knew what our payroll was, we knew what we had to do. And I think, you know, we worked hard this offseason to build the best team possible within that. And I just don't think you can get distracted by what others have. I don't think you can get distracted by, you know, jealousy as to your word or whatever, or complaining about it. You just move forward and try to do the best you can. And I think that, there's only a handful of those in baseball, and that's a good thing, I think.
Yeah, there's a commandment about that. I think thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's payroll, I'm pretty sure.
I think that's New Testament stuff, man. As a reprinting of the King James.
Yeah. I mean, maybe.
The King Bill James Bible.
Well done. Yeah. Well done, sir. Jed, what is fair for Cub fans to do? Because we're going to get both, okay? What is it fair for Cub fans to do? To compare Cam Smith to Kyle Tucker or to compare Cam Smith to Matt Shaw? Which one is more fair for Cub fans to do? Asking for a talk show host.
Oh, I don't know. I think, listen, that's the nature of sports, right? Like I think that when you're sort of building up, you're making trades on the other side of that ledger. You know, you're trading veteran players for young players, you know, it's how you end up with PCA. And I think we're in a sort of a winning window now, and I think you kind of flip that around, and you know, we got one of the best players in baseball, and you know, we gave up a really good prospect that, I mean, I'm proud of our amateur staff for identifying him. I think they did a great job on him, and so I think that's sort of the nature of it, right? That you're gonna make deals on both sides of the ledger, and Cam Smith's a really good player, and so is Kyle Tucker, and I think that's how you have to view it.
Where is the growth for PCA? Because he's clearly got star potential. I thought that watching him and Justin Turner in Japan, like, embrace being there and growing their own personal fan base with people in Japan was awesome. As a player, where can he grow into that thing that everyone's hoping he can be?
Yeah, to me, it's emotional. I think that, you know, he's a very – he plays with his hair on fire. He's very emotional. I think, you know, as he just controls each pitch, each at-bat more, he's going to be a great player. I think that he has all the ability in the world, and he loves the game. He loves to play, and I think that just that's the hard part of this game, right? Is every single day the pitching is really good, and you can't get down about a bad swing or a bad at-bat. You got to go do the next one, and I think that's where, you know, the relationship with, you know, the veteran guys, especially Turner, I think is really important, because, you know, all the tools are there, all the abilities there. He's super fun to watch, and I think that's just, you know, the more he can slow the game down and sort of take at, you know, pitch to pitch, I think he's going to be a great player in this league.
Back to the nature of fandom, to your point. Like, I think the White Sox asked for Rafael Devers when they traded Chris Sale to Boston, and they got told no and ended up with Yoan Moncada. You know, it's like, it's just the nature of it is. And then White Sox fans never forget that. There's a million things, and rather than asking you if the Astros would have taken Matt Shaw or Kevin Alcantara, I'm not going to ask that. But is there a trade in your past that you know you nailed, where you asked for the right prospect, whether it's in Boston or here in Chicago, whether when you were given a short list and you said, I'll take that guy, and you made the right call, I wonder what comes to mind for you.
That's a good question. And I think that, I think you guys are probably asking for, like, you know, deals that were really sexy sometimes. But, you know, one that springs to mind, I guess, was, you know, trading Feldman for Arrieta and Strope. That, you know, we were adamant about getting both those guys. And I think we identified both guys really well as buy lows. You know, I think that's one that really springs to mind in terms of, like, you know, seeing the value in getting both guys. I think that's probably the one that springs to mind. But, I mean, that is the nature of these jobs, right? There's definitely deals I can think of that I won't share where we ended up having a really successful deal and we were actually targeting a different guy, you know? And that happens, you know, and there's other times I think you target the right guy and, you know, he gets hurt or whatever. So I do think that, I've always felt like, you know, the best teams, they have good processes and they're transactional and you're not going to hit on all of them, but if you have a good process and you evaluate well and you kind of stick to that, I think, you know, usually those things balance out over time.
Arrieta and Strope for Scott Feldman as a sign-in flip is one of the great trades in Chicago sports history, to be honest. And I remember talking to you and Theo at Del Frisco's when we did a thing in like 2017 or 16, I don't remember. But I remember asking Theo, hey, how about that guy Kevin Gausman on Baltimore? Do people want that guy too? And he shot me a look like, everybody wants that guy. Everybody. So, like, yeah.
That's a good example. Gausman's a great example of, we messed that one up, you know, like, We targeted him for years, and he went, I'm trying to remember the exact order, but I want to say he went to Cincinnati first and then went to the Braves. And we had a chance to, he wasn't successful there. And we had been trying to trade for this guy for years. And then we didn't go after him after that. Cause like, oh gosh, I guess we might've been wrong on that evaluation. And then he signed the 1 year deal with the Giants and took off. So that was a really good lesson for me, where like, when you like a guy like that and you identify him, don't give up. Like, just because he stumbled somewhere else. And these paths these players take are far from linear. And I think that's like that's something I try to remember all the time too. Kevin Gausman was a highly regarded, you know, first round guy who struggled and on his fourth team hit it, right? And it's just, that's the nature of these of players sometimes.
Jed, thanks so much for the time. Good luck this season, and we appreciate you jumping on with us.
Always enjoy Vegas, guys. Don't think I was gonna leave that out, you know?
Well, one of us is enjoying Vegas, and yeah, the other one is not.
Can we get down on anything for you? An NFL future, for instance. You like Stephon Diggs to the Patriots, by the way? You good with that one?
Aaron Rodgers to the Vikings, maybe? Is that
happening? I haven't read that. But, hey, listen, I like what the Bears have done a lot this offseason. I feel like, I know that's one I would buy hard on. I feel like when you look at how many close games they lost last year, and, you know, the fact, you know, now they're with a better line, and I mean, I know their schedule's hard, but it just feels like that's one where they can be really undervalued in a good play.
I love that. Jed, as always, we appreciate it. Have fun.
Thanks, Jed.
Guys, I appreciate it. See ya. Bye.
You got it. It's Jed Hoyer.
Jed, Bears meatball. Let's get it.
Hardcore, man.
Let's get it.
The other comp I was going to make about, like, Cam Smith versus Matt Schaar or whatever is when Shea McClellan got drafted, and I always think about Chandler Jones and Whitney Mercilus were still on the board as pass rushers.
Man. and for the win, let's have mini categories here.
Yes, sir.
What two numbers did Shea McClellan wear as a Bear?
99. Oh, 99.
And?
54.
No, close.
51.
Close.
55. 50.
Yes. Oh, he wore two Hall of Famers numbers. And let me tell you.
He was not that good.
As someone who was doing a show with one of those Hall of Famers.
Yeah. It did not go over well?
It did not go over well.
That is outstanding.
Man, I loved your show with Mike Singletary.
It was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, they kept, but the only problem was the ratings kept getting lower.
Lower.
We'll take a break. We'll come back, react to that, talk some more absurdities.
White Sox winner.
Oh! And wait till you hear who was pitching at the end of that game for the Angels.
And wait until you hear who made his official plate appearance in that game.
Ooh,
late.
I'm interested.
And got some boos.
Uh-oh.
Next on The Score.